Think about the sun, right? Just this massive ball of power, all running on nuclear fusion. Now imagine bringing that same power source down here to Earth for clean energy.
Yeah.
Basically limitless.
Yeah, that's the dream, isn't it? The ultimate goal of fusion research.
And one of those promising ways we're trying to do that is with something called a tokamak.
That's right. These donut-shaped machines, they use incredibly strong magnetic fields.
To trap plasma. Yeah, plasma. This, like, way hotter than the sun.
It's a monumental challenge, no doubt. But the progress we've seen with tokamaks is pretty remarkable.
Still hurdles, obviously. Big physics and engineering problem.
Oh, absolutely. But it's still a leading contender for future energy. Decades of work have gone into it.
And that's kind of what we want to unpack with you today. We're not going deep into, like, reactor blueprints or the fusion reactions themselves.
No, not that level of detail.
Instead, we're going to look at one really fascinating piece of this whole puzzle. Think of it as a shortcut to understanding some cutting-edge physics.
Getting the inside track on a real scientific mystery.
Exactly. And this mystery, it centers around a specific machine, the TCABR tokamak.
Right, the one at the University of São Paulo. Now, it's not one of the giant ones being built.
Like ITER or anything.
No, but it's incredibly valuable for research. It's really versatile, lets scientists test out diagnostics, new experimental ideas, a real workhorse.
And what's cool is that the plasma conditions they get in TCABR, they're actually pretty similar to what you'd find near the edge of the much bigger tokamaks.
That's a key point, even relevant to the future reactors under development.
So studying TCABR gives real clues about how heat moves, how particles behave, plasma stability.
How it interacts with the reactor walls, yeah, all crucial stuff. And it helps refine those scaling laws we need to predict how bigger machines will perform based on smaller experiments.
And one specific thing they're really digging into on TCABR is this weird phenomenon, spontaneous plasma rotation.
It is weird. You've got this incredibly hot gas, this plasma, inside the tokamak, and it just starts spinning.
Spinning which way?
Both ways, really. Around the short way of the donut, that's poloidal rotation, and around the long way, the toroidal direction.
And the kicker is, it often does this even when nothing is obviously pushing it.
Exactly. No external force, no torque applied, but it spins up.
Like spinning a top without touching it, but with million-degree matter.
Yeah.
And understanding why is super important, right?
Oh, absolutely critical. Because it turns out that controlling, maybe even boosting this rotation, it can lead to much better plasma confinement.
And better confinement is basically step one for making fusion work efficiently. Why is it so crucial, though?
Good question. Better confinement, it just means holding that super hot plasma together more effectively.
So it doesn't cool down too fast or hit the walls?
Precisely. It lets you reach and keep the conditions you need for fusion reactions to happen and release energy. So if we can figure out what drives this natural rotation,
we might find new ways to control it, optimize it.
Exactly. Maybe lead to more stable, more efficient fusion reactors down the road. And today, you get a front row seat to how scientists actually tackle these kinds of problems using real data.
Right. This isn't just theory. We're talking about actual measurements from TCABR experiments used to test these ideas.
And experimental data, well, it's never perfect, is it?
Always noisy, always got some uncertainty baked in.
So we'll explore how scientists use tools, computational tools like MATLAB, to make sense of this messy data, try to pull out the real signal and test their theories rigorously.
So what's the plan for this deep dive? What are we walking through?
Okay, so first, we'll look at how they take that raw data and try to find patterns using curve fitting. We'll touch on using simple polynomials, but also more physics-based nonlinear functions.
And how they judge how good those fits actually are.
Right, assessing the models. Then we'll zero in on one specific theory. It's called the Helander model. It tries to explain that spontaneous rotation based on, believe it or not, how the temperature changes across the plasma.
Temperature gradients driving rotation.
Right, yeah. And the crucial part. We'll see how the predictions from that theory stack up against the actual experimental measurements from TCABR.
Okay, let's kick off with finding those patterns. Polynomial fits. So you've got like a scatter plot of data points, maybe plasma velocity at different spots inside TCABR.
Right. Discrete points, kind of noisy.
And curve fitting is basically finding a smooth line, a mathematical function, that captures the general trend in those points.
That's the idea. You're not trying to connect every single dot because each dot has some measurement error.
You want the underlying signal, the overall shape.
Exactly. The velocity profile in this case.
Yeah.
As you move across the plasma radius.
And why bother fitting a curve? What's the benefit?
Well, several things. First, it summarizes maybe tons of raw data points with just a few numbers, the coefficients of your function.
Okay, concise.
Second, you can estimate values between your measured points. Interpolation. And maybe most importantly, it turns that messy, discrete data into a smooth curve you can work with mathematically. Like you can calculate the gradient, how fast the velocity changes with radius.
And that gradient is often what theories predict.
Right. Very often, yes. So you need a smooth function to calculate it.
Now, how do you know how good your fit is? You mentioned residuals.
Right. Residuals are simple. For each data point you actually measured, the residual is just the difference between that measurement and what your fitted curve predicts at that same spot.
So it's the error of your model at each measured point.
Exactly. Small residual means the model was close there.
And to get the best fit overall, they use the principle of least squares. What's that about? Minimizing something.
Minimizing the sum of the squares of all those residuals.
Why square them?
Good question. Two main reasons. Squaring makes all the errors positive, so positives and negatives don't just cancel out.
Okay, makes sense.
And maybe more importantly, it penalizes big errors much more than small ones. A point far from the curve really increases that sum of squares.
So the fit tries harder to get close to the outliers.
In a way, yes. It prioritizes minimizing those larger deviations.
So in this study, they used MATLAB, the polyfit function, to try both fourth and fifth degree polynomials for the velocity data.
Right. And polyfit automatically finds the polynomial coefficients that minimize that sum of squared residuals.
Why polynomials, though? Why not some other function?
Well, polynomials are really flexible. If you don't have a strong theory telling you exactly what the mathematical form should be, polynomials can bend and curve to match lots of different shapes.
Peaks, valleys, wiggles.
Yeah. By adjusting the coefficients. And the degree fourth or fifth just determines how complex a shape it can make. Higher degree means more flexibility, more potential wiggles.
But isn't there a danger there if it's too flexible?
Absolutely. That's the risk of overfitting.
Ah, right. Where the curve follows the noise, not the real trend.
Exactly. A super wiggly high degree polynomial might hit almost every data point perfectly, noise and all.
But it wouldn't represent the underlying physics very well. It wouldn't predict new data well.
Correct. It's like memorizing test answers instead of learning the subject.
So how do you choose between, say, the fourth and fifth degree polynomials? If a higher degree isn't always better, they use R squared, right?
R squared, or the coefficient of determination. Yes, that's a key metric for comparing models.
What does it actually measure?
Think of it as how much of the story in your data your model actually tells. It's the proportion of the total variation in your experimental measurements that's accounted for or explained by your fitted model.
So R squared of 1 or 100% means the model explains everything. All the points fall exactly on the curve.
Perfect fit, yes. And an R squared of 0 means the model explains nothing. It's no better than just guessing the average value every time.
And the formula involves those residuals again.
Yep. It's basically 1 minus the ratio of the sum of squared residuals, how much error your model has, to the total sum of squares, how much variation the data has around its own average.
So smaller residuals mean a higher R squared, better fit.
Generally, yes.
So in the lab, they calculate R squared for the fourth degree fit and the fifth degree. And often the one with the higher R squared looks better initially.
That's often the first instinct, yeah. Higher R squared seems like it's capturing more of the data's behavior.
But you have to be careful about that overfitting thing.
Exactly. You can't just chase the highest R squared blindly. A super high R squared from a very complex polynomial might just be fitting noise. So you need other ways to judge, too.
Like the RMSE, root mean squared error.
Right. RMSE is another good one. It's basically the square root of the average squared residual.
Okay.
The big advantage. It's in the same units as your original data. So for velocity, RMSE is in meters per second.
So it gives you a typical error magnitude. Like our predictions are typically off by X meters per second.
Exactly. A smaller RMSE usually means a better fit in terms of average prediction error.
And the study probably has a table. Table 1, maybe, showing R squared and RMSE for both the fourth and fifth degree velocity fits.
Precisely. Those values help researchers decide which polynomial provides a reasonable empirical description just based on the data itself.
Okay, so that's using polynomials when you don't necessarily know the exact physics behind the shape. But what if you do have some theoretical guidance?
Then you move towards nonlinear fitting, often using functions grounded in physics.
Right. Instead of a generic polynomial, use a specific formula that comes from theory or common observation. like for the ion temperature profile in this study, they use a canonical function.
Yeah, the formula was T max, T maximine, 1 area R plus T min.
What makes it canonical? Just standard?
Pretty much. It means it's a commonly used, generally accepted form in tokamak physics for temperature profiles. It captures that typical shape, hotter in the middle, cooler at the edge.
Because that 1 area part goes from 1 at the center down to 0 at the edge, right?
Exactly. And the parameters in that equation, T max, T min, and N, they have direct physical meanings.
T max is the peak temperature at the center.
Yep. T max is the minimum temperature at the edge.
And N.
N controls the shape, basically how peaked the profile is. A bigger N makes it sharper in the middle.
Okay, so that's a huge advantage, right? The numbers you get from the fit actually mean something physical about the plasma.
Definitely. Unlike polynomial coefficients, which are often just abstract numbers.
But fitting this kind of function, it's not as simple as polyfit, is it? It's nonlinear.
Correct. You usually can't just solve it directly. You need iterative methods. Numerical optimization.
Which is where MATLAB's L-SKU fit comes in, the squares curve fitting, again.
Right. Same goal, find the parameters, T max, T min, N, that minimize the sum of squared differences between the model and the temperature data. But it does it step by step.
Iteratively. Okay. How does that work?
Well, first you define the function itself, the canonical temperature formula. Then, crucially, you have to give it a starting point, an initial guess for the parameters.
They use 270, 30, 3.5 apparently. Why is that initial guess so important?
Because the algorithm explores the parameter landscape, starting from your guess, looking for the lowest point, the minimum sum of squared residuals. But that landscape might have hills and valleys.
Local minima.
Exactly. If you start in the wrong place, the algorithm might just find a nearby shallow valley, not the deepest one, the global minimum.
So a bad guess could lead to a bad fit. Or one that doesn't even make physical sense.
Precisely. You need a reasonable starting point, maybe based on previous experiments or Bayesian theory, to guide the algorithm towards the physically meaningful best fit. That's a big difference from polyfit, which solves a linear system directly.
So L-SKU fit uses algorithms like Levenberg-Marquardt you mentioned.
Right. It tweaks the parameters, checks the error, tweaks again, trying to go downhill in that error landscape until the changes get tinier, it hits a limit.
And the output is the set of best fit parameters.
And then you'd expect a table 2 showing those best values for T max, T min, and N with their units EV for temperature, dimensionless for N, plus the R squared and RMSE for this fit so you can judge how well the canonical function worked.
We talked about R squared and RMSE for judging the fit, but what about the uncertainty around the fitted curve itself, especially for these nonlinear ones?
Good point. That's where confidence intervals are key, like a 95% confidence interval.
Which gives a range where we're 95% confident the true underlying curve actually lies.
That's the idea.
And that involves the number 1.96 somewhere, from statistics.
Yeah, roughly 1.96 standard deviations for a normal distribution captures 95% of the probability. It's often used as an approximation here, but calculating the interval for nonlinear fits is a bit more involved.
Why? What contributes to that uncertainty range? It's not just how scattered the points are, is it?
No, several things feed into it. There's the data scatter, yes, related to RMSE. There's also the original measurement error on each data point, the error bars.
Okay.
But there's also uncertainty in the fitted parameters themselves. We don't know time x or n perfectly, and these uncertainties can be linked maybe if our estimate for time x is a bit high, our estimate for n tends to be low or something.
Ah, correlations.
Exactly. That's captured in the covariance matrix.
And there's one more factor.
Yes. How sensitive the model's prediction is to small changes in those parameters. If a tiny tweak to N makes the predicted temperature jump wildly at some radius, our confidence there is lower. This sensitivity is described by the Jacobian matrix.
Wow. Okay. So calculating the confidence interval properly means juggling the data scatter, RMSE, the measurement errors, the parameter uncertainties and correlations, covariance matrix, and the model's sensitivity, Jacobian.
Pretty much. The script they mentioned does this complex calculation. It estimates the covariance from the Jacobian and the residuals, then uses the Jacobian again to see how parameter uncertainty translates into prediction uncertainty at each point, combines that with RMSE and data error. It gives a more robust picture of the uncertainty.
And that interval probably isn't the same widths everywhere along the curve.
Almost never. It'll be narrower where you have lots of good data points close to the fit.
And wider at the edges or where the data is sparse or noisy. Makes sense.
You're more confident where you have more evidence.
Okay, fits, quality checks, uncertainty. Now for the physics. The Hellander model for intrinsic rotation.
Right. back to that spontaneous spinning in tokamaks, no external push, but the plasma rotates. Understanding why is huge, especially for big reactors like ITER that won't have much external rotation drive.
And Helander's idea connects this rotation to the temperature gradient.
Specifically, the ion temperature gradient. The model suggests that how steeply the ion temperature drops from the center to the edge can actually drive the plasma to spin toroidally the long way around the donut.
That's wild. What's the formula they use?
The simplified version in the study is VLR equals 2 B-pole, D's tighter.
Okay, let's break that down. VOR is the toroidal velocity we want to predict.
At radius R.
Is geometry.
Inverse aspect ratio, minor radius divided by major radius, just describes the tokamak's shape.
B-pole is the poloidal magnetic field strength to field going the short way around.
Right.
And they have a formula for that involving plasma current, IP, and radius.
Right. Standard formula for B-field in a tokamak.
In D-tight-R, that's the crucial bit, the ion temperature gradient.
Exactly. How quickly tide changes with radius R.
So the model says velocity is proportional to the B-field and inversely proportional to the temperature gradient.
Hang on, let me check that formula again. VR equals 2 B O D to door. Wait. Looking at the source material again, the typical simplified relation often discussed is actually more like V proportional to the gradient times other factors. Let me re-verify the exact form used. Okay, apologies. Reviewing the original context, the simplified Helander relation often implies V is proportional to 1 B-pole, DT dur, perhaps with other geometric factors. The specific formula used in the script needs careful application, but the core hypothesis being tested is that D-titer is a key driver. Let's assume, for the sake of explaining the process, the script implemented a version linking V and D-titer. The essential idea remains. The model predicts rotation based on the temperature profile's slope.
Okay, so the core idea is temperature gradient drives rotation, modified by geometry and magnetic fields.
That's the essence of the hypothesis being tested here. It connects the temperature profile directly to the velocity profile.
But you said this is a simplified model.
Oh, definitely. Real plasma rotation involves a whole mess of physics, particle motions, collisions, turbulence. This experiment tests if this specific mechanism, the link to D-titer, is a significant player in TCABR.
Got it. So how do they test it? First step must be getting that D-titer value.
Exactly. And since we already fitted that nice, smooth, canonical function T-titer to the temperature data,
we can just take the derivative. Calculus to the rescue.
Precisely. The document gives the formula for the derivative. D-titer N, T-I-R-A, N, R-A, N-O.
So you plug in the best fit values for NTPR MAC and T timing that you got earlier.
And calculate the gradient D titer at every radius R.
Then you take that gradient profile and the formula for B tire and plug them into whatever specific version of the Helander formula the script is using.
And out pops the predicted toroidal velocity profile Helander.
This is cool. It directly connects the temperature fit from part two to a velocity prediction.
It does. And it also means if your temperature fit wasn't great, your Helander prediction won't be great either. Garbage in, garbage out, potentially.
So now you have the Helander prediction, Heldern, and the actual experimental velocity data, VFISX. Probably with error bars. Time to compare. Visual plot first.
Good place to start, yeah. Plot them on the same graph, see how they look, do they overlap, same general shape.
But then you need numbers. Quantitative metrics, R squared again.
Yep. But this time, it's R squared comparing the Helander prediction, Helander, evaluated at the experimental points, against the actual experimental velocity data, VFISC. Let's call it R Follander.
So this R Lander tells you how much the velocity variation is explained by the Helander model derived from the temperature data.
Exactly that.
And the other metric, the adherence ratio. How does that work again?
Right. The adherence ratio compares the Helander curve not to the raw data, but to the confidence interval of the best polynomial fit we got for the velocity way back in part one.
Ah, okay. So it checks if the Helander prediction falls within the uncertainty band of the empirical velocity trend.
Exactly. It calculates the percentage of the Helander curve that lies inside that 95% confidence interval of the polynomial fit.
So our Helander checks point-by-point agreement with data, while adherence checks if the overall Helander prediction is statistically consistent with the measured velocity trend plus its uncertainty.
Nicely put. They're complementary checks.
And if both R Helander and the adherence ratio are low, what does that imply?
It suggests that this simplified Helander model based on the measured temperature probably isn't the whole story for toroidal rotation in TCABR under these conditions.
Could mean other physics is more important, or maybe the measurements or fits weren't quite right, or the model's assumptions don't perfectly match the experiment.
All possibilities. It points towards needing more investigation.
And Table 3 would likely show these R-Helinder and adherence ratio values, the key results for testing the model.
That's where you'd look for the quantitative answers.
Okay, but we keep coming back to uncertainty. All measurements have it, error bars, confidence intervals. How do we know if our conclusions about Helinder are robust, or if they changed drastically if the random noise in the original temperature data had just been slightly different?
Excellent question. That's where Monte Carlo analysis is incredibly useful.
Monte Carlo. Sounds like gambling.
Well, it uses randomness, but it's a powerful computational technique for understanding how uncertainty propagates through a system.
How do they apply it here to the temperature uncertainty?
They take the original measured temperature data points, then they perturb them, add a little bit of random noise to each point. The amount of noise added is based on the experimental error bar for that point.
So they create a slightly different but still plausible version of the temperature data.
Exactly. And they do this loads of times. The script mentions 1,000 iterations. So you get 1,000 slightly different randomized temperature data sets, all consistent with the original data and its error bars.
Okay. 1,000 fake but plausible temperature profiles. Then what?
Then, for each of those 1,000 data sets, they repeat the analysis. They refit the canonical temperature function using Elsker-Kerfitt to get 1,000 sets of parameters.
And then they use those parameters to recalculate the Helinder velocity profile 1,000 times.
Precisely. But there's an extra twist. They don't just look at all 1,000 results. They try to optimize.
Optimize what?
They look for the one realization out of the 1,000, the specific set of random temperature perturbations that produces a Helinder velocity profile, Helinder, that matches the empirical polynomial velocity fit polyphival as closely as possible.
Closest match measured by minimum sum of squared differences between the two curves.
You got it. So the simulation finds the best case scenario, the Helinder prediction that agrees best with the overall velocity trend, achievable just by fiddling with the temperature data within its error bars.
So it's asking, within the realm of possibility allowed by our temperature measurement errors, how well could the Helinder model potentially match the observed velocity trend?
That's a great way to put it. It explores the range of outcomes consistent with the input uncertainty.
And comparing this optimized result with the result from the initial fit tells you what?
Tells you a couple of things. First, plausibility. If the agreement between Helinder and the velocity data gets much better after this optimization, it suggests the model might be consistent with the data within errors if it's still poor even after optimizing.
Then the model itself is likely incomplete regardless of noise.
Right. It strengthens that conclusion. But remember, the optimized parameters aren't necessarily true, just the best the model can do given the noise.
What else does it tell you? Sensitivity.
Yes. By looking at how much the fitted temperature parameters and the resulting Helinder velocity change during those 1,000 perturbed runs, you see how sensitive everything is to noise in the input temperature data.
If small random temperature changes cause wild swings in the predicted velocity,
then your conclusions are less robust, highly sensitive. The Monte Carlo makes that sensitivity visible and quantifiable.
Got it. And tables 4 and 5 would show this comparison. Initial fit parameters versus optimized ones. Initial R squared and adherence versus optimized ones.
Exactly. It provides that final layer of analysis, acknowledging and incorporating the impact of experimental uncertainty.
Wow. Okay, that's quite a journey. From raw data in a tokamak.
To fitting curves, polynomials, physics-based functions.
Assessing fit quality with R squared, RMSE. Quantifying uncertainty with confidence intervals.
Then using one fit temperature to feed a physical model, Helinder, to predict something else, velocity.
Comparing that prediction to experiments. And finally, using Monte Carlo to see how sensitive it all is to measurement noise.
It really encapsulates so much of the scientific data analysis process, doesn't it? Extracting meaning from noisy data, rigorously testing hypotheses.
All in the context of trying to achieve fusion energy. Mind-bogglingly complex stuff.
It is, and the specific numbers in those tables would tell the final story for TCABR and Helinder, in this case the R-squareds, the adherence ratios, the Monte Carlo result.
But even if the Helinder model didn't turn out to be a perfect match here, that's still useful, right?
Incredibly useful. Science progresses just as much, maybe more, from finding out what doesn't work or what's incomplete. It tells you where to look next.
Maybe refine the model. Look for other physics. Improve the measurements.
All of the above. That's the cycle of research.
So here's something to chew on for our listeners. given how complex plasma is, what else might you need to measure in a tokamak to really nail down what causes this intrinsic rotation, beyond just temperature and velocity profiles?
Ooh, good question. Maybe electric fields? Density fluctuations? Ion flow details?
Or flipping it around. If Hellander isn't the whole story, what did that tell us about the other forces wrestling inside that super hot magnetized soup? What else is making it spin?
Yeah, it opens up more questions, which is what good science often does. There's always more to learn.
It really is a fascinating quest. We hope this deep dive gave you a feel for the process, the challenges, and the incredible science involved in trying to harness fusion power.
It's a journey of discovery, and hopefully we've shed a little light on one part of it today.